Copyright Forum of Christian Leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
Well, thank you ever so much, Tim, and thank you for coming along to this seminar this afternoon. I just want to chat to you really and talk about science, mathematics, and beauty. There are some things here which will stretch one or two of us, and indeed they make me think a lot, the issues that I've put in, but some of them I think are a little bit more accessible. So I hope there's a nice mixture for some of you to grasp this afternoon. So I want us to think about science, mathematics, and beauty, and I need to make just a few comments about abstract thought to begin with. I love this quote from Einstein: the most incomprehensible thing about the universe is that it is comprehensible. Einstein, of course, was not a believer in the faith of the Lord Jesus Christ, but he was a brilliant thinker, and we can learn a lot from Einstein and many others. So the nature of abstract thought, then I'm going to talk about the nature of mathematics, how is it real, and then I find these middle sections, these will be the ones which really we'll dwell on a bit more. There is an uncanny connection across disciplines in mathematics, which is one of the signposts I'm going to suggest to it being something rather special. So the nature of abstract thought, I'm going to put up a non-mathematician, but again a very brilliant thinker in the 20th century, was C.S. Lewis. And he said this: nature is quite powerless to produce rational thought. Not that she never modifies our thinking, but that the moment she does so, it ceases for that very reason to be rational. For as we have seen, a train of thought loses all rational credentials as soon as it can be shown to be wholly the result of non-rational causes. Now, that's a very famous statement, and indeed, it links with some of the things that we were hearing earlier from Dr. Manuga, who was speaking on artificial intelligence. But it's a very important point that if you, in fact you could trace thought back to the peas that you had for breakfast 2 days ago, then there would be no concept of rationality. That's basically what C.S. Lewis is saying, putting it in layman's terms. Haldane, and of course Lewis had become a believer from Rank Atheism, and it's very interesting to read some of the biographies which have brought that out recently, his gradual path to belief. But Haldane, who wasn't a believer, said something a bit similar, but as far as I know, Haldane never did recant and become a Christian. But he said, if my mental processes are determined solely by the motions of atoms in my brain, I have no reason to suppose that my beliefs are true, and hence I have no reason for supposing that my brain is composed of atoms. Clever, but not just clever, correct? You know, and he's grasping a vital point, and indeed Nagel, Thomas Nagel, has said very similar things to that in recent days. I think hopefully we'll go to see Thomas Nagel eventually come and understand the truth. I'm not quoting him in this talk, but it's very interesting. In Mind and Cosmos, he's got very similar thoughts, because he realizes that neo-Darwinism cannot answer some of the very basic issues, and scientism basically doesn't work. Lennox, whom we many of us know, said this some years ago in his book, God's Undertaker. The whole point, this he's talking here, not about so much about the issues we just said, but the basic point is about DNA that he's talking about, but it's the same issue, really. It's a closely related issue. The whole point about the nucleotide bases, A, C, G, and T, adenine, cytosine, guanine, and thymine, is that they may be positioned essentially randomly. If there were any affinities between them, in other words, if there was any physical chemical cause that they should come together, their information-carrying potential would be drastically reduced. Actually, it's not just reduced, it would be zero, and there would be no value. In fact, Polanyi, who was a very brilliant philosopher in his day and a mathematician, polymath, he said, whatever may be the origin of DNA, of a DNA configuration, it can function as a code only if its order is not due to the forces of potential energy, or you could put there chemical energy, physics, whatever. It must be as physically indeterminate as the sequence of words on a printed page. And the same point applies, as you've just been saying about DNA, to the brain, the mind-brain issue. So I find a lot of the writings on issues to do with DNA are very, very relevant to the issues of whether our mind is just simply an overgrown computer. It's not, as we've been thinking in the scientific network recently. Let's move on. The nature of mathematics, how is it real? Well, for this, we need to realize, and you may differ on this in the discussion, you may want to bring it out, as to what mathematics is, but I essentially regard it as a brilliant means of communication. Now, I know some would go further, and indeed I'm going to quote one or two who would sort of say, no, it's a much more lofty existence than just a communication system, but let's at least accept that it is communication. It may be more, right? And indeed, there's lots of pointers in my talk which might suggest that it is more. But I'm not quite at that point of being totally convinced. So some of these things I'm learning, right? So I'm not saying I've sorted it all out. I think there is some room here for a lot of discussion. It certainly is a code, and it certainly is a language of communication. And the code and the language is more than material, and the message is more than the code and the language. If you read Werner Gitt's wonderful little article that appeared years ago in the Siemens Technical Review, he makes the point that there are five levels of communication. I've just taken two of them, that you need for a communication system a code, which is like a language, which is more than the material, and the message, which is using that language. So not yet at mathematics, but if I've got Morse code there, you wouldn't understand what that is. But if we wrote it in English, it would say John loves Mary. And Mary would obviously appreciate it if John wrote it in a way that she could understand, or he gave her a hug, right? Now, logic and mathematics is similar. It uses logic and symbols, and yet the message can be much more powerful than words can explain, which is why some would say that it hints to something much bigger. And I think it does, actually. But it's difficult to put this into, it's basically difficult to write this idea down. Penrose has tried to do it. I'm going to mention him in a moment, Roger Penrose. But in mathematics, there is something bigger. There is a sense of it suddenly all clicking together. I've done quite a lot of applied mathematics in my day, and I've loved to model real systems. And you've tried one way, try the other way, and it doesn't work, and then you suddenly get it, and it all clicks. And Roger Penrose, who had has the Platonic view that sort of mathematics exists, and was sort of discovering it later, says in his book, The Emperor's New Mind, you have this sense of, I see, eureka, and I understand, and I identify with that. I've had exactly the same sense. I've done what's called asymptotic mathematics, where you have to model a very complicated system by breaking it into zones. And you have to match these zones. And when you get it right, it's absolutely wonderful. It's like a jigsaw coming into place. And all mathematical theories have that sense of clicking. Here's his quote from Penrose. If I've been concentrating hard for some while on mathematics and someone would engage with me suddenly in conversation, then I'd find myself almost unable to speak for several seconds. This is not to say that I do not sometimes think in words. It's nice that he does. I'm sure his wife appreciates that. It is just that I find words almost useless for mathematical thinking. And I understand his point. Sometimes I've, in a much lower capacity in my problems, been sort of gone to bed one night, sort of trying to think, oh, how on earth do I do that? And you wake up in the morning and your mind's been working on it. Bang, it comes together. And there was no particular communication during the night. Maybe my wife saw me experiencing a dream, I don't know. But it clicks. So the book I don't recommend all that Penrose says, but I do like his openness. He's not a Christian, nowhere near, as far as I know, but he's obviously a Platonist, so he is accepting that there is something more than just matter and energy. And that's why I do like his thinking. And he speaks about the non-algorithmic nature of mathematical insight. We'll mention that a bit later again. Inspiration, insight, and originality, and it's the non-verbality of thought that he's particularly stressing there. Another brilliant mathematician who actually was very much instrumental in dealing with quantum mechanics is Eugene Wigner. And he died in 95, but he did grasp this point. He talked about the miracle of the appropriateness of the language of mathematics for the formulation of the laws of physics. And it's a wonderful gift which we neither understand nor deserve. We should be grateful for it and hope that it will remain valid in future research and that it will extend, for better or for worse, to our pleasure, even though perhaps also to our bafflement, to wide branches of learning. And he then goes on to say, other things as well, but this miracle is an interesting use of the word, isn't it? And he then goes on to say this: the great mathematician fully, almost ruthlessly, exploits the domain of permissible reasoning and skirts the impermissible. That his recklessness does not lead him into a morass of contradictions is a miracle in itself. Second use of the word miracle. Certainly, it is hard to believe that our reasoning power was brought by Darwin's process of natural selection to the perfection which it seems to possess. And of course, I totally agree, because if you know, I would not accept that mathematics has arisen out of the mud over billions of years. It's something which is transcendent to matter and energy. And that's basically what the Platonists will say, and the Christian, I think, will agree. But we would go further, as of course we would recognize, and perhaps that will come out in discussion. Let me now come on to the uncanny connections across disciplines. Now, I'm going to put up some equations now. Oh, you'll say, some of you, but don't worry. If you're from a more arty background, actually, I've done this talk to artists, and they've understood the basic point that I'm saying. So I hope I will make it accessible. Most of you perhaps are from the sciences, but I think you should be able to grasp the point that I'm now going to make. You won't have heard of this, some of you, but many of you will have heard of it, because I know some of you are physicists. The Laplace equation, very important equation, occurs in physics, and it describes heat diffusion. But it doesn't just describe heat diffusion. It describes low-speed fluid flow, where the F in that case is the velocity potential. And it's not velocity, but it's something linked to velocity. But it also applies to electromagnetism. And it is so powerful, that equation, because it transcends all the disciplines. Now, that is something which is rather wonderful about applied mathematics. It also applies, or also comes into play, with the connection with pure mathematics, because pure mathematics will sometimes take an applied mathematical problem and think, just a minute, this is part of a much wider, you know, they might talk about n-dimensional space, and solve a problem in totally unreal systems from the applied mathematician's point of view, but suddenly out of their pure maths comes something which comes back into the real world in a totally different area. And this is the value of mathematics, which is why some people feel that it's more than a communication system, and I respect their argument. The wave equation, which is a very, very powerful and fundamental equation in the sciences, applies not just to strings going up and down there or water waves there, but it applies in many other areas as well, right across the physical world. We have wave equations with quantum mechanics, we have wave equations in water, we have wave equations in strings, and very many other practical areas. So if I summarize it there: sound, light, radio waves, electromagnetic waves, water, and so on and so forth. So there is a universal nature of mathematics which comes out of what I've just been saying. And let me just sort of dig a little bit deeper here. There are some constants which occur in mathematics which are very, very powerful. You don't need some of you for me to say that there is a special function which, when you differentiate it, remains the same. And it's to do with a base called the natural e, the natural logs, logarithms. And that number, e equals 2.71828, therefore becomes a very powerful constant which goes right across all the real world. Then you've got another constant, which, of course, the Egyptians and the Greeks were very much aware of, which is pi, which is the ratio, of course, of the circumference of a circle to its diameter, 3.14159, and you can carry on. But pi is also linked with E and another constant, which you can't give a number to, which is I. I is the square root of minus 1. And of course, people say, well, you know, you can't square root minus 1. But actually, in the mathematical world, as the pure mathematicians were sort of thinking into this, they said, well, why can't we? Let's invent a system where you can have it. And lo and behold, this is an illustration of the value, by the way, of pure maths. For a while, I was doing applied maths, and my wife was doing pure maths or joint maths in those days. And I was thinking, do pure maths. I was an undergraduate. And I hadn't sort of seen how valuable pure mathematics is. But here's an illustration. Pure mathematics began to think, well, why can't we have a square root of minus one? And lo and behold, they developed a whole system of thought where if you do allow it, then you can get e to the I pi, which is minus, comes out to be minus one, plus 1 is equal to 0, which is Euler's identity. And this whole system of thought is very relevant to, coming back to the practical world, to stability of systems, where you've got rotation, where you've got cyclic phenomena, whether you've got engines which are going to be analyzed by Rolls-Royce and General Electric and other engine manufacturers, wherever you've got something which is dealing with a rotating device, anything which is undergoing a cyclic phenomenon, then this is going to be highly relevant, and you plot things in the imaginary and real plane. I'm going to move on because I want to just mention some other points as well. The use of surds, that means square roots and difficult numbers, complex numbers, which I've just mentioned, non-integers, which again was an important point in the history of mathematics, when you go into it and Melvin Bragg has dealt with this in his program In Our Time. He had a whole program on the history of mathematics, and he did it very well, where basically the mathematicians had to realize that there was such a thing as non-integers. To us, it's obvious, but that had to be invented in the pure mathematical world. And so what was originally thought to be, well, we can't find a number for that, now becomes at least an approximation, even though it goes on and on. So root 2, which is a very important number, and of course pi, I'm sure you all know, can actually be, perhaps some of you can recite it up to that, but you know, you can keep on going with pi. There are some people who have whole competitions, you know, reciting pi to us, I don't know, 50, 60, 100 decimal places. But it still isn't exact. It goes on and on and on. And of course, there is an infinite number of numbers in between 1.1 and 1.2, or in this case, between 3.1 and 3.2. So that's a hugely important concept. The number of numbers that you can have is now infinitely increased. And you can play around with that point philosophically, which I'm not going to do now. Then there are other very fundamental algebraic relationships. I'm sure you know this one, and you can recite it in your sleep. I tell my student, or was telling my students that until I finally retired, but the number of third-year students who still couldn't remember how to solve a quadratic equation was phenomenal. But, you know, these things are important fundamental algebraic relationships which are rigid. They cannot be changed. And I can understand some people saying, like Roger Penrose, they exist. And he has a sort of thought in his book, these things exist. Well, yes, I can understand the point. But I wonder whether, as Christians, we can put it in a better way, saying that the Lord knows that they exist, and he knows those concepts. Is mathematics more than a language? Interesting point for questions. Now, still talking about the fundamental nature of mathematics, the connections of geometry and key ratios go further into an area which brings out yet another constant. It's the golden ratio. And it does seem to occur a lot in nature. This seashell has it. You get this ratio, which I need to actually tell you what it is. It's 0.618. And it's a ratio which can actually be approached by a series, which I'm going to show you in a moment, called the Fibonacci series. But this ratio actually occurs in nature. As you can see, this is the ratio of sides, which will be 1.618. If you invert this, you get 1.618. And all these rectangles are in the ratio of the long side to the short side to 1.618. And this is where it links with art. Leonardo da Vinci and the Mona Lisa, which was shown there just a moment ago, and many other people in the Greek world, when they were building the Parthenon on Athens, they were using, sometimes intuitively, and I think it may have been intuitive with some of them, others it was deliberate. Leonardo da Vinci was very good with physics and understood a lot about the principles even of flight. So it may be that he did that deliberately with the Mona Lisa. But it is significant that this ratio keeps occurring in nature. And it is there as something which most artists, if they're doing something in the classical art, that is, would appreciate as being more beautiful than just putting up a square. It's also linked with another shape, which is the pentagon. And the pentagon actually has this property that it works with the golden ratio, because it's to do with 5 and it's to do with root 5 when you actually work out these lengths. If you take that length A, if you take that length B, that length C, which is there, that length D, which is that one there, and then you look at some of these lengths, you find that D plus C is equal to B, and C plus B is equal to A. You also find that B over A is the golden ratio, and that C over B is the golden ratio, which is an interesting finding. And D over C is also the golden ratio. And you have this golden ratio in a pentagon. Well, the pentagon is linked actually with a lot of things which, again, you find in nature. Some, not all flowers, but some flowers, like the petunia, do actually fit very nicely into a pentagon. There is a connection with that which we find beautiful in nature. Here's the Fibonacci series that I mentioned, which is 0, 1, then you add those, you get 1 again, you add 1 and 1, you get 2, you add 2 and 1, you get 3, 3 and 2, you get 5, and so on. And you find that the further you go on, you can actually write down a formula for it, but the further you go on, the number in one place in the Fibonacci series divided by the number before approaches, as you go on, phi, which is 1.618 here, the more you go. So it's linked with the Fibonacci series, and it occurs throughout the natural world. If you look at a pineapple, it will usually have spirals. So this is the set of spirals here, but if you notice, the spirals going in that direction. And there's also, if you look carefully, there's another set of spirals which are like this, Okay, all these spirals. So you can count the number of spirals. Next time you get a pineapple, count the spirals. I like to say to my wife when she's got one, I say, are you sure it's a Fibonacci pineapple? Put it down again if it isn't. But the golden ratio isn't necessarily, though, defined by optimization, which could be an argument of a skeptic against the golden ratio appearing in nature. And to do that, I've actually got to come out of my talk and actually show you another program in order to illustrate this. So just bear with me as I pull it up. What I'm going to do is I'm going to show you a program which somebody has actually put together, which actually deals with this issue. And just pull it up, got it here.
There we are.
So you can go to other possibilities. That's the point that I'm making here. So even though that's not the golden ratio, right, you can actually populate that circle with a different packing order, right? Now, the reason why this is happening like this is that what's happening is that it's obeying a particular formula, which is this, that the radius is governed by the number of seeds that you're dealing with. So you're starting off from the center with two or three seeds, and then you're moving out. And depending on the number will determine what the angle is that you deposit the seed. And if you're dealing with the golden ratio, then that number would be 1.618. But I've deliberately made it 1.63 to show you that you can pack, you can populate that circle with that number of seeds and still get them in. So coming back to then the talk that I was just sharing with you now, if we come back to our slide, I've now got some pre-programmed examples. So that's the golden ratio. And this is, if you Google David Chandler, you can find this program and play around with it yourself, okay? He's actually got it there. Now, here's some other examples. That's the golden ratio. This is way off the golden ratio. And here's another example, way off the golden ratio. So I'm anticipating the argument of the skeptic who says, well, there is an optimization system and it's bound to do that, isn't it? It's bound to actually produce those patterns. Actually, it's not bound to, because this shows you that you can have alternatives. So my point is that this is linked with beauty in nature, which is where I'm headed to in what I want to share with you. Charles Darwin said that when he looked at the peacock feather, the sight of the feather in a peacock's tail, whenever I gaze at it, makes me sick. The reason it made him sick was that he couldn't really understand why there was such a thing as beauty. Now, you could try and explain the peacock's feather and its beautiful design of the false eye, which is recurring all the way through the peacock tail, as being something due to, you know, the appreciation of the peahen. But if actually you look at the behavior of a peahen, it actually goes behind the peacock very often and pecks at it as if to say, I'm not interested, and what on earth are you putting up your tail like that for? Well, we don't know it's doing it for that reason, but there doesn't seem to be a lot of connection between a peahen's appreciation of that and the peacock's display. I would suggest to you that it's far more to do with beauty that we appreciate. There is actually, in the eye of the peacock, there is some lengths which are following roughly, it's not exact, but it's roughly in the area of the golden ratio. I mentioned the golden ratio being connected with art. Instinctively, an artist will tend to put something off-center, and the amount that it puts it off-center is usually to do with the golden ratio. In other words, that distance to that distance will be usually of the order of the golden ratio. It even occurs in music, although it will depend. Some parts of music do have it. Bach is full of it. Bach particularly was aware of this golden ratio. Einstein said this: how is it possible that mathematics, a product of human thought that is independent of experience, fits so excellently the objects of physical reality? Kepler said geometry has two great treasures, one the theorem of Pythagoras, the other the division of a line into the extreme and mean ratio. The first we may compare to a measure of gold, that's Pythagoras. The second we may name as a precious jewel. So I put that before you, that there are amazing connections in mathematics. There is also some amazing examples of symmetry. Okay, this applies to the base 10 system, so I agree that it's very much a product of the base, but it is interesting that 1 times 8 plus 1 is 9, 12 times 8 plus 2 is 98, and so on, and you get these patterns developing. Here's another one: 1 times 9 plus 2 is 11, 12 times 9 plus 3 is 111, and so on, and you get these amazing patterns occurring in mathematics. Yet another one produces 8s everywhere. 9 times 9 plus 7 is 88, 93 times 9 plus 6 is 888, and so on. And yet one more is this one, which has 1s all on the left-hand side, and gradually you're building up 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and then going down again, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. There are some amazing link-ups in the base 10 mathematics. Of course, if you do base 9, base 8, you'll also get patterns as well. But mathematics is full of patterns, which is not surprising. It doesn't mean that it's transcendent just because it has patterns, but it does mean that when you get something which is very useful, and base 10 is exceedingly useful, that it also seems to have beautiful patterns with it as well. Let me just come on to the power and coherence of mathematics. We dealt with the universal nature of it, and I'm going to give you two examples showing the power and coherence, I should say, of mathematics. So I'm going to stretch you a bit here. I'm going to mention Dirac's equation, and I'm also going to mention a boundary layer equation. Dirac's equation led to a new finding of particles in physics, and it's based really on the Schrödinger equation and another term, which is the momentum equation. So you can see here that there is a wave term in here. Those of you familiar with some of the mathematics here, this is the wave term. But you've also got a momentum term here. You can see that you've got here constants to do with particle physics and Planck's constant. And this predicts, the Schrödinger equation, predicts four solutions as two paired solutions. So an electron is predicted here, which of course people knew about, but it also predicts positrons. So that then led to people saying, let's go and find them. And that's the wonderful power of correctly applied mathematics. If you've got the principles, and Schrödinger had got encapsulated the principles of the physics, he then went to complicated mathematics to try and resolve that equation, and ended up predicting things which hadn't yet been found. And that is the tremendous power of certainly applied mathematics. Dirac actually commented on this, and again, as far as I know, no friend to the Christian position. It seems to be one of the fundamental features of nature that fundamental physical laws are described in terms of a mathematical theory of great beauty and power, needing quite a high standard of mathematics for one to understand it. You may wonder, why is nature constructed along these lines? One can only answer that our present knowledge seems to show that nature is so constructed. We simply have to accept it. Yes, he's saying a lot there. One could perhaps describe the situation by saying that God is a mathematician of a very high order, And he used very advanced mathematics in constructing the universe. That's a tremendous admission on the part of one of the greatest physicists in the 20th century. Let me come to the other example, which links a bit with the mathematics that I've done. I wouldn't like to give you an example of in combustion, which is what I dealt with, acoustic waves linking with combustion. This is, believe it or not, a simpler case. You might not think so, but this is Ludwig Prandtl, who brilliantly, one of the best German mathematicians in his day, solved the problem of the flow going over an aerofoil, which of course is highly pertinent to what sadly happened later on in the 20th century. But he had to solve the fluid flow equations. But the problem is you've got this rather nasty number here called the Reynolds number, which compares the effects of free stream flow with the viscous forces which are reducing that flow near the boundary. Okay? So you had this brilliant idea, well, let's split the flow into two regions and then match them. And it worked. Basically, you re-look at the flow using what we call stretched coordinates, where you redefine the distances very close to the boundary, and you actually find that you can resolve the flow there with simpler equations, which I'm not going to put up. Oh, sorry, I do have them, but don't worry about them. They're there, but don't worry about them. So you get simpler equations which you can resolve, and then away from the plate, you knock those terms off because Reynolds number is large, and you just solve those traditional free flow equations, which can be worked through. And this works, and like Penrose, you get the sense of it being like a jigsaw, and it comes together. There is a similarity to the same deep sense of pattern and aesthetics from music. You get the sense of everything coming together and it fitting beautifully. And there is a real sense of beauty and a profound sense of achievement. And in my view, mathematics straddles the arts and the sciences. In fact, when I did my degree at Bangor in the University of Wales, they had a BA as well as a BSc. So, whether or not you like Mendelssohn's violin concerto is not the point here. It clicks. There is a sense of wonder that mathematics achieves something which you can't achieve just by slogging away at a computer program. Mathematics is more than computing. And I want to stress that point. Because these days, with big computers, and I've often had this argument in the university and other places, people say, oh, you don't need to do mathematics anymore, you just get a big enough computer, you solve everything. Well, it's very true, you can do an awful lot more these days, but you still can't get the root of the problem sorted out. And so many students, of course, do just that. They think that, oh, well, if I just sort of play around on the computer, I can do that mathematical problem. No, you can't. Because garbage in, garbage out, we well know. So, now, this leads me into Gödel's theorem. Now, Gödel was brilliant, and we've dealt with this in the scientific network before. And he proved, and I've summarized it here, and if you don't like my summary, forgive me, but people have expressed it in all sorts of ways. Any effectively generated theory capable of expressing elementary arithmetic cannot be both consistent and complete. In particular, for any consistent, effectively generated formal theory that proves certain basic arithmetic truths, there is an arithmetical statement that is true but not provable in the theory. I know that sounds difficult to understand, but what it basically means is that there are assumptions in any mathematical system which you are basically assuming and you can't prove. And he proved that very theorem. And it was a very significant step when he did that because it basically knocked away the idea that you could reduce everything just down to an algorithm, including our brains. So it's very relevant to the mind-brain issue, which we've been discussing. In other words, if I put it up here, it's a simpler version. There are axiomatic assumptions in mathematics which prove that it requires something outside of itself. So it really is stressing the transcendental nature of mathematics, and in fact, the transcendental nature of any rigorous study of reality. And it's true in science, which is Gödel's theorem, but actually, really, it's true in art as well. There is a transcendental nature in any good art. It's got to be. Even in bad art, I guess there is as well. Of course, that begs the question as to what's good and bad, and I'm not going to go there at the moment. John Lucas, whom Angus mentioned the other day, actually summarized quite neatly the implications of Gödel's theorem. And he said, I won't read it all, "The machine will still not be an adequate model of the mind. Thanks to Gödel's theorem, the mind always has the last word." And I think he's right. Not necessarily everybody will agree with John Lucas, because, of course, the atheist will want to say that the energy and matter is all that there is. But I do believe that there is a powerful apologetic here, and I just want to just mention one or two other examples as I come to a close. I'm just dealing here with the beauty of the mathematics itself. Kepler's planetary motion is summarized basically by some very simple looking formulae, right? The time period for a planet going around the sun, or any planet going around its star, is determined by the gravitational constant here, and the two masses and the radius and so on. But of course, this leads to the actual predictive ability that comes out of Kepler's laws of planetary motion. Look at Einstein's equation. Look how simple it looks, and yet it's profound. So usually when you've got a very complicated formula, it doesn't always apply, but usually you question it if it's exceedingly complicated. You think, I wonder whether I've got this right. Have I made a mistake somewhere? And the mathematician will often go back through his work to say, it shouldn't be as complicated as that. Einstein had written something very profound, which of course showed itself in some horrific examples, but also in some good examples. Horrific because of Hiroshima, but good examples because of nuclear energy and many other things that we do have today. Now, I love this one because this is Maxwell. And Maxwell was clearly a believer, right? Now, Maxwell, I think Maxwell and Faraday were the two greatest scientists of their day, because Faraday intuitively understood that electricity and magnetism must be connected, and he demonstrated it in the Royal Institution. He didn't really understand mathematics, but he had a brilliant intuitive understanding. Maxwell was just the opposite. He could just carry all these concepts in his head. He was probably the greatest mathematician, I would even say, applied mathematician anyway. And he put all these laws of electricity and physics, and magnetism together. And he realized that actually those very equations were predicting the double nature of an electromagnetic wave, which of course, is, as you look back, you think, well, actually that's not surprising, but in the day it wasn't known. Those very equations enabled him to predict the speed of an electromagnetic wave. Remember, it hadn't yet been measured, but he predicted it. And it's on the permeability of free space and the equivalent in magnetism. And he predicted what the speed would be, and lo and behold, when Michelson and other people measured it, it was almost exactly right. I find that one of the triumphs of mathematics, which just cannot be beaten. And Einstein had a huge respect for Maxwell. As it says here, in a brilliant leap of scientific insight, Maxwell showed, using a succinct, it is very succinct, mathematical model, that light was an electromagnetic phenomenon. And I find that extremely powerful example. Penrose, back to Penrose, he said, a beautiful idea has a much greater chance of being a correct one than an ugly one. I think he's right. Now look at Dawkins. The universe we observe has precisely the properties we should expect if there is at bottom no design, no purpose, no evil, no good, nothing but blind, pitiless indifference. One of my friends once met Dawkins and had a bit of an argument with him, tried to be gracious to him. Eventually, Dawkins sort of said in a huff, "My brain is just a lump of meat." Now, once you start saying that type of thing, I believe it leads to ugliness, because you've lost the transcendent nature, not just of art, not just of ethics, which of course has to be, from a Christian point of view, transcendent, but you've even lost the mathematics, because mathematics is not produced by mud over billions of years. And of course, as you can tell from Schindler's List, which I'm playing, I'm linking it with the ugliness which comes from looking at the world in that way. Nietzsche said, "God is dead. God remains dead. We have killed him, yet his shadow still looms," and so on. You've seen that quote before, I'm sure. He died. 1900 odd, aged 55. Somebody put on a wall, "Nietzsche is dead. God." Who has the last word? In the end, God laughs at these theories, which don't even understand the science properly, let alone all the issues of aesthetics, which I've linked it with, and beauty. Do we have a German here? Maybe we do. But I respect Peter Imming and Alex Fink, who run the Science Network. But this is a brilliant philosopher. I don't think he was a Christian. I can ask Peter Imming. "Mathematics is a rock upon which naturalism founders. If non-naturalistic Platonism is yet to stand a chance," so I would go further, obviously, to a Christian position, but I think Platonism, you know, is an acceptable dualism, is an acceptable start, at least, in the argument, "then it is in the question of the existence and nature of mathematical entities." So he's arguing that in order to destroy the atheistic monism, which is basically what is being propounded today, you've got to go into the area of mathematics. That's his point there. Okay? You can have these quotes afterwards if you don't manage to get them, because I want to finish and give you time for question and answer. He goes on to say, "Philosophical naturalism is a thesis about the world which possesses a multitude of possible routes to being falsified. In my opinion, the strongest arguments are that mathematical entities may be, have to be interpreted inevitably in Platonistic terms." So my conclusion is, man in the image of a transcendent God is actually borne out by the very mathematics that he uses. Remember this? I had it up earlier. I'm just repeating it. It is hard to believe that our reasoning power was brought by Darwin's process of natural selection to the perfection which it seems to possess. And I love this one. This is Max Planck, who gave his name to Planck's constant. Look at this. "That is, in the first place, scrupulousness in criticism of self bound up with perseverance in the fight for true knowledge, and in the second place, honorable regard not to be shaken by misunderstandings for the personality of scientific adversaries, and finally, a lasting confidence in the force of the word, which for more than 1900 years has given us an ultimate infallible test for distinguishing false prophets from true. By their fruits you shall know them." If Max Planck had such respect for John's gospel, because that's what he's quoting there, but the word he's quoting there, but that is another scripture, we need to think again. And I think we need to use these great scientists and what they said. Faraday, who perhaps is my real hero, said this on one occasion, "Therefore our philosophy," like we would use the word our science, so he's using it in a different way, "whilst it shows us these things," and he's done an experiment at the Royal Institution, "should lead us to think of him who has wrought them, for it is said by an authority far above even that which these works present, that," Romans 1:20, that the invisible things of him from the creation of the world are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead. So I think the argument in mathematics is a very powerful one. The conclusion is, the nature of our mathematical ability implies strongly a transcendent God. We are made in his image. We are a reflection of his own transcendence. And this should be used in our apologetics. I believe the mathematical argument is a very powerful one. And remember, Planck was effectively referring us to John 1, where it says, in the beginning was the Word, the logical principle behind everything, of course, is Christ. But it includes, it's not just this, but it includes the logic in mathematics, the logic in physics, the logic in chemistry, the logic in biochemistry. May God bless us all, but I hope that's just been of some help to you, to show you the connection of science, mathematics, and beauty. Thank you.